This podcast is brought to you by MyScore IQ. MyScore IQ services are here to help you be prepared when it comes to making big financial decisions, such as buying or refinancing your home or purchasing that new car. Try it out for only $1 for a 7-day trial. You'll receive your FICO scores from all three major credit bureaus, along with active credit report monitoring and alerts for changes to your credit report and possible suspicious activity.
MyScore IQ services can help you be in the best position possible when you take that step to apply for a home or auto loan, all for $1 for a 7-day trial. Visit MyScoreIQ.com/Todd to learn more. That's MyScoreIQ.com/Todd.
Welcome back to another episode of Talking Stocks. It's what we do. Joe and Todd with you here as always. Todd, it's snowing. What the heck is happening outside?
You know, New England, this is why nobody likes you, New England.
Yep. What can we say? This is just what happens sometimes. So now I've just got my fingers crossed that the power doesn't go out because the wind is whipping outside. Hopefully my microphone isn't picking up on the rain that's just blasting against my windows right now.
Exactly.
Hopefully there aren't any ocean waves mixed in there too, like the one that hit my car on the way home. Jeez. Yeah. Anyway, it's been a fun Friday in New Hampshire, everybody. Hope you're having a good one as well. Yeah, Todd's got a hard stop at 4 p.m. and here we are at 3:06. So we're gonna dive right in. First thing I want to talk about is Coinbase. Big IPO this week. The only way you didn't hear about it is if you were like out backpacking in the woods for the whole week and weren't checking Twitter, because it's been all over the news. What's the market cap? 100 billion, either side of 100 billion. Just crazy stuff. So Todd, fill us in a little bit on what's been going on with Coinbase.
Yeah, remember this was a direct listing, Joe, so it wasn't a traditional IPO, but they did set a reference price, and that reference price they set was for 250. It's kind of a ridiculous, I mean, with IPOs, usually when you're on a roadshow, you're kind of getting a feel for where to price it based on your conversations with the big investors, because obviously we want to line up the big investors to make sure that you have a successful IPO launch. So I think with the direct list, you're basically, there's a little bit more guesswork there as far as setting whatever price it may go public at. There were rumors that this thing could go public at, you know, 100 billion plus in market cap. I don't think we're quite there, that we're probably a little bit below that at this point. But sure enough, well above the reference price. We traded over 400 when it first started trading, like 1 o'clock that afternoon.
Amazing.
Earlier this week, you know, $150 higher than that so-called reference point that they had set for it going into it. And then of course it just, you know, but there was so much gamesmanship in that, Joe. I don't know. I mean, maybe you can give, I know that you and I have talked briefly about crypto in the past, but maybe you can give a quick overview of your take on, you know, what's Coinbase? What is it?
Sure. So actually I could just open it up on my phone right now and kind of show you guys what it looks like. So it's really, I would call it, it's Robin Hood for cryptocurrency. So anybody can create an account. It's super easy to do. This is what the interface looks like. If you can see that, if you're on YouTube and you can see that. So there are, I think, 60 or 70 different cryptos that you can trade. So, you know, the big ones, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Ripple, Litecoin. Interestingly, I found out that Dogecoin is not traded on Coinbase, which is a real bummer because Dogecoin is up, like, it's been up 100% 3 days in a row now, I think. It's up 118% the past 24 hours. Anyway, getting sidetracked. The best way I could describe Coinbase is Robin Hood for cryptos. They have not been under the same scrutiny as Robin Hood has in the past couple of months, luckily. And so they're considered the front runner, the market leader in cryptocurrency trading. They're the leading cryptocurrency trading platform. So certainly, they have that first mover advantage. They have, I don't know how many users they have off the top of my head. I'm sure it's at least in the tens of millions. And there is billions and billions of dollars being traded on their platform on a daily basis. So certainly something to watch going forward. I've heard just some insane projections as to what Bitcoin's going to do in the next 6 months to a year. I've heard 200,000. Todd, yeah, go ahead.
Jump in real quick on that, because I pulled up prior to our conversation today, just the latest, this from CNBC that was posted, I don't know, a few days ago, earlier this month, leading up to the IPO. The company says that
is in Coinbase.
Coinbase, yeah. Their first quarter revenue climbed more than ninefold year over year to 1.8 billion with a B, so billion, almost 2 billion in the quarter. And that their net income jumped to at least 730 million.
Wow.
From 32 million a year before.
That is quite the margin.
So you start talking about, okay, well, is Coinbase worth 80 billion? Is it worth 60 billion? Is it worth 100 billion? The question, I mean, if you extrapolate growth and where we are now at an 8 billion, that's not crazy price to sales.
Yep.
And the fact that they're, you know, generating 730 million, that's almost a 3 billion in net income annualized. It's not insane pricing for a high growth company.
Yeah, it's inflated for sure, but it's not as inflated as some of the others that we've seen recently. Like the first one that comes to mind is Snowflake, which was just outrageously priced.
Right, right. Yeah. And you know, what's weird about that too, is people are like, how do you think about Coinbase, Todd? And I was like, oh, well, it's a trading platform, like you said. And then I was like, or is it an exchange? Or is it a custody company?
Like a clearinghouse?
Yeah. I mean, cause it's actually got its toes dipped in a lot of different things when it's, you know, across that life cycle. It's, you know, I mean, with equities, you've got the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ as their own entities, right? Or you've got with commodities, you've got the CBOE or the CME, or you've got ICE, you've got all these other exchanges, right? And then you have, you know, the trading platforms that allow the transaction to occur, like a Robinhood, right? And then of course you've got, you know, okay, well, I can maintain my assets here. And you know, there's a pro platform where, I mean, the big complaint right now is, yeah, but all those are about fees, Todd, right? The fees are so high. And isn't it likely that we're going to see fee compression, right? So as more people are trading crypto and more platforms start to allow crypto on it, won't it just be like we saw with stocks, where, you know, you have this race to zero in the commission world? To which I guess I would respond, well, we all learned earlier this year with Robinhood that you don't need to charge commissions to make a lot of money in this business if you're in the middle, right?
That's right.
So it could very well be that if they are, I mean, they compete, you know, tooth and nail with what Gemini is another one out there, the Winklevoss brothers, and then there's also Binance and there's some others. And of course, you know, you can now do, you know, you can buy some crypto, I think, on Robinhood. I think that's where you'd have to go to get Dogecoin, I think. Like you said, it's not in Coinbase. So you do have to make some assumptions, right? You have to assume that cryptocurrency is going to continue to be something people want to own, right? But I tell you, Joe, and yours, you know, it's for the younger generation, maybe. Like, but my generation, I don't know. I'm like one of my only people in the friend group that actually owns cryptocurrency. So I think there's a lot of people out there who still don't have cryptocurrency, especially within maybe that, you know, Gen X and up age group.
For sure. Yeah, it's one of those interesting things. Like I'm far from an expert. I mean, I'll be completely honest. I don't know jack about cryptocurrency. And I'd be lying if I said that I did. So I just wanna say that up front. Definitely don't take my advice. I'm definitely, you know, we're both definitely more stock people. But that said, I would say probably half the people I know who invest have or have had some sort of cryptocurrency position. I personally have a cryptocurrency position. I had bought back in like the first kind of bubble phase in 2017. I bought a couple of Litecoin, which is considered a Bitcoin alternative, one of the more popular ones, but certainly no Bitcoin. And that went on a very nice price surge this week. And so I actually, instead of selling it, I transferred it into an equal value of Bitcoin. So I now own like 0.00, maybe another 0.08 of a Bitcoin. And I figure I'll ride it out for a little while and see what happens from, you know, see how all of these crazy predictions pan out, at least for the summer. It'll be fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I started my crypto experiment. Anybody who follows me on Twitter has probably seen me post about my crypto experiment. I think I started that earlier this year, just based on, you know, so many people that I was interacting with on FinTwit, but also based on the class that I teach, how to talk stocks, and how many of my students were interested in cryptocurrency and asking me. I felt like the best way for me to be able to provide them with some insight was to actually explore the platform and try doing it myself just to see what it's like. And, you know, I've actually built up a pretty good stake in a few of these now. And it's literally, this is just trend following. This is just chart reading for me. Bitcoin, obviously. Actually, my biggest position is Ethereum, which I think we talked about Ethereum in the past on the show when we were talking about non-fungible tokens and, you know, trying to figure out how you enable transactions through blockchain and cryptocurrency. And then I also own a little bit of Litecoin, and I'm up on all three positions at this point. I think I'm actually up the most on Litecoin, but I put the least in it. So, whoops. But you know, we'll take that for what it's worth. And it's still in the experiment phase. It's a relatively small portion of my portfolio. I want to say that as of our speaking today, it's only about 1% total of my net worth, maybe even less than that. But it's growing. I am averaging up. I just bought some Bitcoin again last night above 60,000. I'd promised myself that I would continue to average up, and 60,000 had been a place where it had continued to stall. So what I told myself is, oh, we'll see it get over 60,000, we'll see it settle down a little bit, and I'll take some more. So that's what happened. I got to 65,000, dropped back down to about 63,000. I've added a little bit more through my Coinbase account. It's interesting, going back to Coinbase for a second, what's interesting is just how difficult it is to get onboarded.
I don't really remember, because I would have done it like over 3 years ago now. So it's also totally possible that it's changed completely. So what was your experience?
I would say that Coinbase and Gemini were both easier than Binance. I gave up on Binance.
I think I had tried Binance too. I think it was Binance. And I had the same issue. I just remember like not being able to get my account activated for some reason.
Yeah, and something about it felt sketchy as I was going through the onboarding.
Yeah.
I felt like I was giving the keys to my castle to some foreign entity. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to stick with Coinbase and Gemini for now. Both of those onboarding processes went a little bit smoother because they actually use a company that isn't public yet called Plaid that allows you to basically connect very quickly your financial information to those platforms. I still had to go through, though, this verification process to be able to trade meaningful size and to be able to transfer money in and money out. Coinbase was much faster on that. It took me weeks, but it was probably half the time it took me for Gemini to get verified on those platforms. So it is an interesting process. It's not like you can just, on those platforms anyways, really just open up these accounts and start trading in massive size. Which I think is probably a good thing, because, you know, having some circuit breakers on, as we're seeing now with a lot of these highly speculative stocks, these pre-revenue SPACs and stuff that have been beaten up pretty hard in the last 3 months. Having some circuit breakers that maybe slow people down from just chasing whatever's hot because other people have talked about it might not be a bad thing. Right. But it is, Coinbase is an interesting business. I don't own it right now, Joe. I don't know if you bought any the other day on the opening.
I didn't.
Okay. Yeah. And I got a lot of questions about it in the classes I taught this week. A few students had bought it. I pulled up a bunch of IPO charts for the class, and viewers and listeners, you might want to do that when you get home or get to a terminal where you can actually pull up some charts. But, you know, look at the first month or two of a lot of these. Joe mentioned Snowflake, which is a little bit of an outlier, but you can still see over time. Airbnb, Uber, Roblox, Bumble. Pull up some of these IPOs that have been pretty successful or have just, were pretty big and people were aware of. One of the things you'll notice, Joe, is that almost all of them pull back to the IPO price or at least the first day trading price or undercut. And I think I've seen some research in the past that says about 80%, 70 to 80% of all IPOs will do that. So I think you can be a little patient. You don't need to be chasing this necessarily. And that's going to be my strategy. I can see owning it in my growth portfolio, but I haven't pulled the trigger on it yet.
Yeah, same here. I've made a couple of pretty foolish mistakes on IPOs in the past, so I tend to avoid them, just because I'm a lot more cautious with my assets than probably most people my age, which is why I don't have a gigantic position in Bitcoin as well. I think that said, I think that Coinbase is a very good company. I think they will continue to grow just meteorically, and I think that if they can maintain that level of profitability, it won't be long before I will be investing in it. But you know, that's still probably at least 1 to 2 months out as the price just kind of stabilizes. Because today, I mean, it's up 5%, but that's off of a peak of, what is this, 427? Is that possible? 429, yeah. Actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, on whatever day it opened. The days are all a blur now, Wednesday. Yeah. So, yeah,
and you know, I think this is probably a good insert actually to talk a little bit about the research and the way the scores go, because you know, we run these scores continuously, but a number of the components rely on history,
right?
So, the seasonality component, the long term money flow component, the earnings beats history component. So, sometimes I'll get asked by people, why do these SPACs or these IPOs, why don't they score better in your research? Just to head that off the past, that's why. That's why, because the score is going to get better over time. So the more information that we have to digest in our machine, the better the output will be from the machine. So just as the nature of the beast, IPOs and those kind of things are punished in our research. And I haven't minded that historically, because as I've cited the research prior, 70, 80% of IPOs at some point usually come back down, roll back down, and then end up going. So this has been kind of an abnormal year in that a lot of these IPOs and SPACs went on to double and triple and put up these crazy, crazy numbers. So anyways, I just wanted to insert that there for listeners who are also subscribers, free link below, you know, to have a little bit of understanding of why those score the way they do in the model.
Yeah. Todd, just to wrap up, does Coinbase have a score in the research yet, or is it too early?
Too early.
Long will it be?
We'll try to get that into the system by the end of the month, okay. But the scores are going to be pretty low and pretty sloppy for a little bit because we got to get a little bit more history.
Yep. Yeah. A lot of the scoring model relies on historical data. So yeah, keep that in mind. But there, as Todd said, you know, there's a reason to that. Post IPO stocks tend to be pretty volatile. So it makes sense. So let's pivot a little bit to a company that is a little bit farther along in their timeline. I want to talk about NovoCure at least briefly this week, because that was a total surprise. I don't know if that caught you as much as it caught me by surprise, but that news is huge. And for people who are stricken with these certain types of solid tumor cancers, and for their families and their loved ones, this is really good news, right?
Yeah. So NovoCure, and we can talk a little bit about what NovoCure does, but just to generally speaking, it is a cancer or oncology company. They've developed a device that can deliver what they call tumor treating fields, or TTFs, to the tumor. And these fields basically operate on specified frequencies that, you know, inhibit the multiplication and division and therefore the expansion of cancer cells. Joe, does that sound fair a fair explanation of TTFs?
Yes, full disclosure, I am a former NovoCure employee, so I'm no scientist, I'm no engineer, and I'm no nurse. So I worked in the business operations side of things, and so I know generally how the technology works. But yeah, that's pretty much spot on. So at the moment, they only have like full FDA approval to treat two different types of cancer. One is called glioblastoma, which forms kind of like on your, just like right where your hairline is, basically, or sorry, I should say where a young person's hairline is. No offense, Todd, wasn't directed to you. And then also they treat, this should sound familiar to everybody, mesothelioma. If you've ever watched television in the United States ever, you know, at least a little bit about what mesothelioma is. So caused by asbestos, you know, the spiel, if you are a loved one, da, 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 da. But it's a type of lung cancer. And so, but it's very rare, at least compared to this new indication that they have, right?
Well, yeah, and it's really, the trial is still ongoing. It's a phase 3 trial. We were expecting to see data, I think, in 2022, but there's an interim data point that I think was supposed to come later this year. A lot of times with these trials, Joe, they'll have independent data monitoring committees that are looking at the data. And the company will remain blind to the data, but these monitors can see it. And sometimes when you have something that's very effective, where the efficacy is very good, you'll have the monitors issue a recommendation to make a change to the protocol for the trial. And that's what happened with NovoCure this week in their trial for non-small cell lung cancer, which is a very common and sadly a deadly cancer that can occur. I mean, there's about 180,000 of these cases diagnosed every year in the US alone.
That puts it in like the top 5 or top 10, right?
Exactly. And I think the 5-year survival rate is sadly only about 20%. So there's a definite big need to disrupt this. And what this phase 3 trial was evaluating is whether or not adding this TTF device to checkpoint inhibitors or chemotherapy improved results versus those checkpoint inhibitors or chemotherapy alone. So the question is, can you use this as an add-on to increase overall survival? And that's important, Joe, because a lot of trials, cancer trials, are targeting progression-free survival. Overall survival is the gold standard, though. It is if you can deliver an improvement in overall survival, you have a very good likelihood of becoming a part of standard care, right? Because, hey, there's something on the market that's been proven to make me live longer. That's what you're going to prescribe me, is what the patient is going to be saying, right? So the way, what they did is they cut the number of people in their recommendation. The FDA hasn't signed off on it yet, right? But the idea is that they'll cut the number of people that will enroll in the trial. And then rather than the 18-month follow-up, they're going to shrink that to a 12-month follow-up. So theoretically, you'd get the final data that could allow them to submit for FDA approval in that indication a little bit quicker. What's interesting about this, Joe, is we talk a lot about oncology stocks in the healthcare sector. A lot of them are pre-revenue because they're still in clinical trials or they haven't generated a profit yet, right? So what's interesting to me about this is in glioblastoma, they've already become profitable, right? They earned 20 cents in 2020. They're spending a lot on clinical trials this year, so that drops them to 17 cents in profitability. And then 2022 expected to bounce back to 44 cents per share. And then if you look at their revenue in the fourth quarter, $144 million in revenue, up 45% year over year. And I think investors are, obviously, if this can get improved in a much larger indication, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think glioblastoma is only about 12,000
Something like that, yeah.
Diagnosed annually. So you're talking about a significant increase in their total addressable market for this company if they can actually land the approval. So that's why if people were interested in the stock or were following it or saw it, it had a jump. I think it was 50% at one point.
It was.
On that news.
Yeah, insanity. So I just to put this into perspective and kind of wrap it up, if I recall correctly, when I worked there, this was last summer, so 2020, they had in the neighborhood of 5,000 patients, give or take, And so they were making $144 million in revenue off of those 5,000 patients. So you think about all of, you think about non-small cell lung cancer as just one example. Todd, how many diagnoses did you say there were in the US each year?
I want to say it's over 180,000.
Right. That's like off the charts for them. So definitely going to be a fun stock to watch.
Solid tumor, right? That's not the only solid tumor they're going after, right, Joe? Either.
Right.
We've got trials ongoing.
Pancreatic cancer, I believe liver cancer.
So as more of these come through and we get data on these, I mean, it certainly adds, I guess it adds a little bit more conviction to the idea that, well, maybe this will work in other solid tumor cancers too, which is another reason why it probably went to the moon this week.
Yeah, it's really, really promising and really exciting. So I want to pivot now to something that unfortunately is not very exciting and is something that's been kind of going on behind the scenes, really flying under the radar, it seems, of mainstream media and really mainstream FinTwit too. So I wanted to take the opportunity today to dive in a little bit into the ongoing global semiconductor microchip shortage. So for those of you who don't know, and we've talked about semiconductors on this show many times before, and so later Todd will get into the specific semiconductor stocks that are worth looking at right now. But basically, you can think of a semiconductor as a small computer chip that goes into just about anything that's digital in any way. So we've seen interruptions in the supply chain for cars, for computers, obviously. So anything that has a computer chip in it is going to be affected by this, which these days is almost everything. I mean, that's your appliances, right? It's your smartphones, automobiles, I said. And as we keep going on with this, I'll think of more and more examples. So first, I wanted to give just like a really high level, holistic look at this. So you viewers and listeners can kind of see why this is happening and what it's going to affect and how you can kind of prepare for it, even though it's already kind of happening, and then also hedge against it. So there are a lot of reasons why this is happening, just kind of a culmination of all sorts of different small to mid-scale events that have really added up and have hindered the production of semiconductor firms and semiconductor factories, specifically over in Asia. So Taiwan Semiconductor is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, Todd, is that fair to say? Yeah. So it's really interesting, actually. There's a drought, an ongoing drought in Taiwan, which means that the factories that make these semiconductors in Taiwan have not been able to produce at their regular full production rate, because evidently they need some amount of water, I guess a significant amount of water, to cool all of their machines. I don't know the ins and outs. I'm no manufacturing expert by any means. Additionally, there was another semiconductor factory in Japan, I guess a pretty big one, that suffered a fire and has been essentially offline for quite some time now. And I didn't know this, but apparently there are also semiconductor factories and facilities in Texas. And so back when that big deep freeze happened, what was that, in February, I think? We talked about it on one of our episodes. I believe it was in February, though. That also created some disruptions that are just really just trickling their way down all these different pipelines throughout the economy. So back to what's effective. Let's see if I missed anything in my list here. Yeah, so anything that connects to the internet. So this whole, you know, IoT, Internet of Things revolution. So it, especially if you have a newer home, you have a lot of things in your home that have semiconductors in them. So your Nest thermostat, your refrigerator, your washer dryer, your television, laptops, desktops, phones, tablets, smartwatches, anything that either connects to the internet or has a display has one of these in it. And so it's tough to say right now how that's going to impact prices. Specifically, I do know that PC components, so people who shop for PC parts and then build their own PC for gaming or crypto mining or just for personal use, the graphics card is like the most expensive component of one of those, generally speaking. The prices of those have approximately doubled since this time last year. Wow. So, I mean, the graphics card is really just a big fancy semiconductor. And so you can understand why. And those are made by the big semiconductor companies, specifically the two biggest ones are NVIDIA and AMD. Motorola is in there as well. So that is really like one of the first areas that we've already seen some sort of effect. I know also there's been some news in the past week or so about some, I believe it was GM, Ford, and maybe Nissan had to cut production in half at some of their facilities in North America. So this is going to lead to higher car prices, probably both new and used cars, I would think. Especially if Ford is only able to produce like half the F-150s that they usually do. And then it really becomes more of a discussion between the two of us, Todd, because we could kind of debate and speculate and kind of go back and forth about, well, what businesses are actually going to see a financial impact from this? And so I know the automakers are going to be hurting. Where was the stat I had? Ford and GM both have said recently that their profits will be reduced by at least $1 billion each because of this shortage in this fiscal year. So that's significant. I mean, I don't know how much profit Ford made last year, but probably only a few billion, I would think, right?
Yeah, those are big numbers. And, you know, I think that's, Pete, you're right, that people aren't really paying as much attention to it maybe as they should, although we are seeing a lot of talk in DC and trying to convene together, maybe like focus groups or you know, people to get people together in a room and try and figure out, okay, how can we overcome some of this supply chain disruption and boost capacity so we can actually meet the demand that's out there? You're right, they're doing these rolling shutdowns of assembly lines, which obviously is going to reduce the number of units that you could sell. It may, on the other side of the things, provide a little bit of pricing power because maybe you won't have to discount the vehicle or the whatever product it is that you're producing as much. And certainly some companies, it looks like they may enjoy some pricing power, probably in the middle though. I'm not sure to what degree NVIDIA and AMD and those guys are going to actually jack up prices and kind of hurt the people who are buying from them most consistently over time. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with pricing from there. I think one of the things that we've seen, and we've been talking about semiconductors as moving up in the ranking and being viable since last fall. I think one of the things that you need to start doing now though, is becoming a little bit more selective in figuring out which of these you want to own, which of those you don't. NVIDIA is one we talked about on the show recently. I think that's one you can absolutely buy because I think long-term tailwinds towards next-gen chips are pretty strong. And so that's one that I would definitely have on my radar as one to buy. I think you really can look at the semiconductor equipment stocks as well, because think about it. If the goal of anything out of Washington or anywhere else is to increase capacity and maybe even build in some redundancy in supply of chips, well, that means that people are going to have to buy the machines that are used to make chips. So you know, that provides a nice natural tailwind for you know, some of the companies that are in the semi equipment space. The other thing that I would throw out there is that the industry is a little bit notorious for the people who consume the chips for overinflating their orders. So ordering more than they really need to try and move up the chain and get more faster from the, from. So I think a lot of these chip manufacturers are trying their best to balance what they're viewing as real demand against what supply they can create, even though on the order book, it looks like a, even more is necessary. It might be that some people are inflating what it is they actually need. And Joe, if you want, I can share my screen and we can talk about some of the highest scoring still in semiconductor.
Sure, go right ahead.
All right, so I'll go ahead and do that. And if you're listening on one of the platforms, just know we do post these on YouTube. So you can pull these up and you know, look at the charts alongside of us when you get home or to a computer. And you can see right now I have the semiconductor ETF, the XSD. Joe, you can see that on the screen?
Yep.
Okay, great. And you can see that really the big part of that move was here at the end of October and then running all the way up through mid-February. And since then, it's kind of been trading sideways. I will say some of the individual stocks ran longer than this. I actually was starting to take off some of my own personal exposure in January, trying to get out in front of what I view as seasonal cyclicality to the book-to-bill ratio, which is orders and divided by the order shipped or fulfilled by the, tends to run in a normal seasonal cycle that typically starts to run out of steam once we get into the second quarter. So I had sold off too early some of these stocks. But right now we're still operating in this channel and we could certainly continue to move higher. And if I look at more closely at the seasonality, it looks like May to June is where you really start to peak out and then start to trend down in the third quarter. And then you usually get a nice run again beginning in that fourth quarter. So if you're trying to figure out, okay, how should I be treating these or looking at these going forward? Maybe that's kind of the model that you have inside of your head. I wanted to take a look at some specific stocks that you're still interested in hunting for some of these. And right now, Joe, what I'm looking at is just an Excel spreadsheet where I've broken out the highest scoring of the semi stocks. And one of the things you'll notice, Joe, by looking at this, the top is dominated by what?
Equipment, just like you were talking about.
Yeah, semi equipment and materials are definitely the highest scoring in our works. We've got iCore Holdings, ASML, Lam Research, and then Nova Measuring. So if you look at iCore, ICHR is the symbol there. And you can see, wow, what a big move it had coming up here in March and rising up here into early April. And now it's trending sideways here. And you know, above this 21-day moving average, I would be interested in buying it. So I'd be buying it anywhere in this 59 area. And then I could sell if it broke the 21-day moving average or not. But we get 29% year-over-year revenue growth in the December quarter. We've got 22% expected earnings growth next year, 25% expected earnings growth this year. And what this company, Joe, does is it does a lot of manufacturing for these semi-equipment companies. So, you know, I don't know if they work with Lam, but for example, if Lam doesn't want to manufacture all the parts for its equipment, maybe it would contract out with iCore to build some of those components for it, right? ASML is another one in that semi-equipment space. And again, man, what a move that stock has had. Fell to 500 at the beginning of March, now all the way back to 646, 15% year-over-year revenue growth in the December quarter, 22% EPS growth expected this year, another 23% expected next year. And again, I'm fine with taking it up here and then running a stop underneath it to stop myself up below the 21-day moving average. And then Lam, which is kind of like I've always considered to be kind of the golden, you know, this is the one you want to own in semi equipment. You can see how it had that nice, broke out of that channel. Looks like, when is that? Early first on April 1st. And now it's kind of digesting some of that. And again, not a lot of volume here as it's digesting. I think that this could go higher as well. You've got 34% year-over-year revenue growth in the December quarter and 57% year-over-year earnings growth expected this year. So those are the strongest scoring right now that maybe people want to throw in their watch list. And if they get a down day, take a swing at and add it to the portfolio.
Yeah, definitely worth a look. All right. Well, anything else this week, Todd? Anything else you want to throw into the mix?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking through the rankings overall. We seem to be kind of like a, you know, still tilting towards defensive baskets. So, you know, you see consumer goods scoring pretty well. Energy has started to slide down. There are some cracks in the armor. Seasonally, still pretty strong period for it through the end of the month. So I think I'm going to let those, I'm going to hold on to those for a few more weeks and see whether or not large cap energy starts to exert itself again. Mid cap energy still looks okay. Industrials still look okay. Healthcare is still weak, and on balance, technology is still weak. So even though we've seen a nice little bounce back in the NASDAQ, I think that, you know, the market is telling you that, you know, you have to be very stock specific or maybe even industry specific within that basket. It's probably a better way to phrase it. And then, you know, whereas in maybe some of these other stronger baskets, you can be more, hey, whatever's in the basket I can take. With that being said, I know we're running a little bit long, but I do have a couple stocks here that I can share as just general ideas outside of semis that people might want to take a look at if you want to do that.
Go right ahead.
All right. So I'm going to share my screen again and again. You can get these on YouTube, so feel free to watch us there as well.
I'll put a link in the show notes. Don't worry.
Fantastic. All right. So I wanted to pull this one up. It's kind of a battleground stock because it's got a high short interest in it. It's called National Beverage, and they're best known for making LaCroix, which is a sparkling drink. 2021 earnings per share expected to grow 34% to $1.86. January fiscal quarter, sales were up 10% to $245 million, and just been basing sideways and now breaking above the 50-day moving average, and volume started to come back into it. So I think there's an opportunity for some upside there. I also want to pull up a bank, good old-fashioned boring bank. We did see banks report financials, by the way. I'll add that to the mix of very strong across large, mid, and small cap, even though we are seeing some of the longer-term bond yields fall the last couple of weeks. Anyways, First Financial Bank Shares is a mid-cap bank operating across Texas that happens to score really well in a research, looking to have revenue grow to 147 this year. EPS grow to 147 this year. 17% year-over-year revenue growth in the December quarter. And again, just looking at entry points, I like to use the research to highlight stocks, and then I like to look at the charts to kind of help me figure out, is this a good time to buy? And I like this uptrending 50-day, just recovering the 21-day now, could go up to this 52 again, which would be another nice 10% move higher in the stock. Frontdoor is a stock that I'm interested in personally, but I haven't bought it yet, so I haven't done my due diligence on it yet. It provides home service plans under the brand name HSA, OneGuard, Landmark, and American Home Shield. And again, I would imagine that this is a beneficiary of increasing residential home sales and improving consumer discretionary income. Scores high in our work, FTDR. Going over to the energy area, focusing a little bit on refiners, and honestly, gasoline stocks, Joe, score pretty well for the research. Phillips 66 Partners, symbol there is PSXP. Looking at 8% EPS growth this year, followed by 5% next year. Again, nice little move out of this recent recovery of the 200 and the 21 day. I think we could get, especially when you look at it on a weekly chart, just looking at the distance that this thing could travel. I mean, in 2019, it was a $55 stock. It's currently trading around $33 today. And Sunoco would be another one where the weekly chart, it shows that it's actually back into that prior high from 2019. But if it can get above this 34, which was that prior high, I think that it could run substantially higher. So S-U-N is the symbol there. And then just give one more. Lovesac reported earnings earlier this week that were better than anticipated. Revenue was up 41% year over year. Earnings per share grew substantially, 270%. And you're looking at 2023 forward estimate for fiscal year up 166. We did see a sell-off on the earnings per share, but I think that's because there was some gamesmanship there, people buying ahead of earnings, hoping to spin it quickly. As a result, shares actually sold down the 2 days following, but we saw it hold the 50 and the 21-day moving average. And now today, up about 10%. So I think that that's got, obviously, you know, to me, that suggests that maybe there's some institutions that are sitting underneath this thing that want to accumulate a position, and they're willing to use, you know, the weakness like we saw earlier this week as an opportunity to pick up some shares.
Yeah, Absolutely. All right. Well, we're running a little bit long, and Todd, I know you have a hard stop, so I think we're going to leave it there for the week. If any of you viewers or listeners have any more insight or questions to offer about the chip shortage, I know we gave just a really, really high level overview this week. We could have an entire podcast series about the chip shortage. But anyway, we're happy to further address it in the coming weeks. I think it'll be a concern that comes up repeatedly throughout at least the spring and the summer. It'll be interesting to watch. So I think we'll leave it at there for the week, and we'll see you all next week. Take care.